Every home could be searched for the slightest crust of bread or grain of wheat. Even a corn cob being dried out in order to harvest the seeds for planting in the spring was fair game. As historian Ann Applebaum recounts, the activists also had instructions to return to surprise people in order to catch them unaware and with their food unguarded. In many places, the brigades came more than once. Families were searched and then searched again to make sure that nothing remained. They came three times, one woman remembered, until there was nothing left. Then they stopped coming. Brigades sometimes arrived at different times of day or night, determined to catch whoever had food red-handed. If it happened that a family was eating a meager dinner, the activists sometimes took bread off the table. If it happened that soup was cooking, they pulled it off the stove and tossed out the contents. Then they demanded to know how it was possible the family still had something to put in the soup. Not only was there no place to hide food, but there was little possibility to hide having had any food. Anything other than increasing gauntness was an indication that a person was, somehow, providing for themselves. One glance at a face told the activists everything they needed to know. If a person somehow managed to find and conceal food, that only forestalled the inevitable. Their own body would betray them. Starvation was not simply a consequence, it was the goal, and it was the law. Stalin intended to break the Ukrainians once and for all. It thus became common for villagers to spy and inform on one another. Turning in a neighbor for having a sack of grain might be the easiest and safest way to procure food for one's family. Not only was there a guarantee of a meal, but there was also now a guarantee that said meal wouldn't be seized by the requisitioners. Further, those who could not produce a quota of grain were subject to a fine of 5 times the value of what the grain would have been, yet another reason to seize property and savings. Not having the food to fulfill one's quota was taken as evidence, if not downright proof, that one must have been hiding it. And if the food was being hidden, then why wasn't it being handed over? Many of the tactics could only be explained by pure sadism. In some villagers, the requisitioners went from house to house, killing all the dogs and then taking their bodies with them for good measure. Fingers would be slammed in doorways or needles jammed under fingernails. Those found concealing food were robbed of the remaining possessions, evicted from their homes, and thrown into the snow without any clothes. To ensure that the starving peasants did not somehow steal the food that they so desperately needed, fields and barns were kept under armed guard. The activists even came for the tools used for making food, breaking millstones necessary to process grain. If they took soup from a hungry family, they made sure to take the pot as well. The Soviet media accordingly began a campaign portraying the kulaks as illiterate, selfish, subhuman hicks. If you were hungry, and everyone was hungry, it's because the greedy kulaks were hoarding food. After all, everyone knew that the Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. It is little surprise that those few who managed to make their way to the cities, destitute and barely clothed, were therefore often treated with unmitigated contempt and as worse than animals. As one Soviet citizen later recalled, "One day, as I waited in a queue in front of the store to buy bread, I saw a farm girl of about 15 years of age in rags and with starvation looking out of her eyes. She stretched her hand out to everyone who bought bread, asking for a few crumbs. At last, she reached the storekeeper. This man must have been some newly arrived stranger who either could not or would not speak Ukrainian. He began to berate her, said she was too lazy to work on the farm, and hit her outstretched hand with the blunt edge of a knife blade. The girl fell down and lost a crumb of bread she was holding in the other hand. Then the storekeeper stepped closer, kicked the girl, and roared, 'Get up, go home, and get to work.' The girl groaned, stretched out, and died. Some in the queue began to weep. Even basic human sympathy was grounds for suspicion, which was then grounds for arrest and the most serious legal consequences. 'Some are getting too sentimental here,' the storekeeper announced to the crowd. 'It is easy to spot enemies of the people.' Everyone on that line would have known what he meant by those words and what danger they would have put themselves in if they had fed the starving teen. As one 1934 Soviet novel later put it regarding the kulaks, not one of them was guilty of anything, but they belonged to a class that was guilty of everything. Pregnant women trying to steal food were beaten to death, with their remaining children invariably starving. Children who tried to feed themselves were shot as well. Digging mass graves became grueling work, and barely living kids and the elderly were tossed alongside the dead in order to save the extra trips. Their last hours on earth would be spent slowly dying, surrounded by the corpses of their countrymen. While a kulak had originally meant a small-time farmer, such kulaks had only accounted for no more than 5% of the population. Simply having 3 cows and 25 acres was enough to brand one as a kulak. But the system in place to identify the kulaks created the most malevolent of incentives. "It was so easy to do a man in," recalled one Ukrainian writer. "You wrote a denunciation, you did not even have to sign it. All you had to say was that he had paid people to work for him as hired hands or that he had owned 3 cows. Worse, the poorest could do little to defend themselves, while the wealthier residents could afford to bribe their way out of baseless accusations. The interconnectedness of economics led to a ripple effect throughout the economy. The mass slaughter of farm animals led to an acute leather shortage. As a result, making shoes on an individual level became a felony in order to force everyone to have to get their shoes from the government, which often fell apart immediately. It's easy to see why the Russian population at large was oblivious to what was being done to the rural Ukrainians and how they could be led to regard them as the villains instead of the victims, especially after centuries of rivalry or outright animosity between the two peoples. The dishonesty of the Soviet press can be seen through a typical anecdote, which was the Russian method of using humorous stories to state otherwise unspeakable truths. One day, Soviet President Mikhail Kalinin was in Moscow making a speech about how much the country had improved. He got particularly excited discussing the new 20-story skyscrapers on Karl Marx Street in Kharkov. A worker in the audience quietly stood up to protest. "Comrade Kalinin, I live in Kharkov. Almost every day I take a long walk on Karl Marx Street. I haven't seen any skyscrapers." "That's the trouble with you, Bart Kalinin. You waste your time promenading instead of reading the newspapers and learning what's going on in the country." As for the rest of the world, their mechanism for learning about what was happening abroad was a function of what they read in their own newspapers. They had little other choice but to trust the media to uncover the truth and to keep them informed. This the media did not do. As Hitler prepared to seize power in Germany for the first time, the Western papers did pretty much all they could to deny and obscure Stalin's starvation of millions. Journalists working in the Soviet Union were in a very tricky position. The entire state edifice was organized against them being able to report honestly and fairly on the situation within the socialist country. Their housing and accommodations were a function of the state, which could be revoked overnight without explanation at any time. Their internal communications would be monitored, and they themselves were often followed around as well. Worse, any story that they filed had to make its way past the Russian censors, whose job it was to make sure that the Soviet position was represented abroad in the best possible light. The tricks the censors could use were infinite. A reporter on Deadline might as well bang his head against the wall when up against a faceless, gigantic bureaucracy. A censor could easily claim, sometimes even honestly, that he needed approval from his supervisors before allowing a story to be released. Supervisors who did not feel the slightest bit of pressure or inclination to approve a story and whose names and contact information would not be available to the frantic journalist. The pressure on the censors from their supervisors was similarly quite intense. One negative story in the Western media, and it would quickly become clear who it was that let such an article out of the country for publication. The mechanics of bureaucracy meant that what could easily pass muster one week would be regarded as completely beyond the pale the next. Sometimes this would be a function of the party line changing. Today's hero of the revolution would be tomorrow's enemy of the people. But other times, it would come down to simple mind games. Any given reporter was constantly aware that he was there at the discretion of the Soviet Union and that it would do well for him to err on the side of caution when it came time to report on what he saw and heard. There was thus an enormous incentive for Western journalists to write stories sympathetic to the Soviet point of view. In addition, there were very many Western journalists who genuinely were sympathetic to the Soviet point of view. A country built on equality, where everyone is provided for, where hunger and poverty were abolished, certainly sounded like a noble goal, irrespective of what was transpiring all around. One Russian correspondent described the mindset of his colleagues, pointing out that every nation has had its contingent of professional interpreters of Russia who have made it their life's career to maintain appearances for the USSR as utopia in construction. With few exceptions, they are a high-minded crew, coloring and concealing things with the noblest motives. Devotees of the theory of multiple truths, they speak more candidly than they write, and they think more candidly than they speak. They would as soon give the undiluted truth to their politically backward countrymen, whether readers of The Nation or the comic strips, as they would administer poison to children. Theirs is the logic of old-fashioned mothers who lie about sex to pubescent daughters. The American public, in their view, is simply too young, politically speaking, for the facts of Russian life. A few of them I know have inner qualms. The rest, on the contrary, feel positively heroic, strong in their ability to dispense with petty bourgeois prejudices about truth and mass brutality. When it came to coverage of the Soviet Union, first and foremost was the paper of record, the New York Times. The Times man in Moscow was a reporter named Walter Duranty. There is something to be said for the fact that as a young man, he was close friends with Satanist Aleister Crowley, whose shaved head and declaration that "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law" so shocked Victorian sensibilities. In addition to smoking opium with Crowley, Duranty began an intimate relationship with Crowley's mistress before marrying her himself. In 1929, Durante managed to secure an interview with the world's most sought-after subject, Stalin. His reporting from within the USSR earned him the 1932 Pulitzer Prize, journalism's highest honor. It was Durante who in 1921 had insisted that, in a country rotten with corruption, the communists are honest. In 1923, after Lenin's famine that also killed millions, Durante wrote that, "Lenin has often been called the Red Dictator. This designation is wrong. Lenin never had the right to dictate, although in practice, his opinion generally carried the day." Lenin earned his position because of his greatness, insisted Durante. The secret of Lenin's authority, which did in fact amount to dictatorship, was that long experience had proven him right far oftener than his colleagues. Durante also downplayed the mass terror unleashed by Lenin's secret police. In point of fact, it is doubtful whether the total number of Cheka executions through the whole period up to 1922 surpasses 50,000. I once asked a group of bitterly anti-Bolshevik Englishmen, most of whom were in Russia when the revolution occurred, in which all lost dear friends or property, what they estimated the total Cheka executions at. No one put the figure higher than 100,000 for the whole country. The majority placed it much lower. One, quoting as an analogy the French Revolution, whose victims the great historian Michelet estimates at 4,000, put it as low as 20,000. Though lives were cheap and Russia and the Cheka leaders pitiless in defending the revolution when in danger, they would have defeated their own object by the wholesale slaughter of workers and peasants on the scale reported abroad. In 1922, the Cheka was briefly reorganized as the GPU. In terms Americans could understand, Durante explained that that meant that in exceptional cases, exceptional rights will be given to the detectives of search, arrest, and so forth. But beyond that, a measure of civil rights and freedom not greatly different from those enjoyed in America, France, or England is promised to Russians and foreigners alike. And I venture to say that no one who behaves himself has any more to fear from the GPU than the average American citizen has from the Department of Justice. After all, Stalin is anything but remote or autocratic in method. In 1932 and 1933, the New York Times was denying that the Soviet government was targeting the Ukrainian rural population with terror and genocide, just as less than a decade later, it would obscure the news that Hitler was targeting German Jews. Durante covered it up from the very beginning, explicitly telling readers in November of 1932, "There is no famine or actual starvation, nor is there likely to be." Sometimes his choice of words was quite telling. "It is a mistake to exaggerate the gravity of the situation," he continued. "The Russians have tightened their belts before to a far greater extent than is likely to be needed this winter. But Russians, just as with any other group of humans, only have to tighten their belts when they're losing weight. In the West, this is sometimes due to a change of diet or exercise. In Soviet Russia in 1932, it most certainly was not." Over the following days, Durante went on to report that the food shortage is insignificant as compared with conditions in 1920, and that the Bolsheviks are simply trying to introduce a new form of farming, which they believe to be better and more efficient, not only for the peasants, but for the nation as a whole. As people went insane from hunger and were driven to, in some cases, eat their own children, New York Times readers could rest assured this was simply a new form of farming. Of course, it was possible that Durante was simply naive. Maybe he was being played by Stalin's forces to repeat what they wanted, right? Well, no. The New York Times reporter went out of his way to reassure American audiences that this was not the case. He let them know that, "I have just completed a 200-mile auto trip through the heart of the Ukraine and can say positively that the harvest is splendid and all talk of famine now is ridiculous. Indeed, the populace, from the babies to the old folks, looks healthy and well-nourished." As for why so many of the peasants were traveling so far looking for food, he had an explanation. "Today, the labor turnover runs to 100% or more per year, due partly, no doubt, to hard conditions and the hope of finding something better elsewhere, but even more to an ancient habit of wandering and the desire for change." Durante's readers could thereupon be happy to explain that, for Russians, searching for food was just a custom and not at all an urgent necessity in the face of death. Durante's message worked. There was a systemic consensus among Western journalists covering the USSR to minimize the nature and causes of the Ukrainian catastrophe. There were only a few exceptions. When the London Times published an unsigned article about what was going on, Durante swiftly went on the attack. To the London Times correspondent, collectivization is one of the blackest spots in his gloomy picture. He writes, "During the last 2 years, 70 million peasants have been driven from 14 million holdings onto 200,000 collective farms. Those who have proved themselves successful farmers, i.e. kulaks, are hunted down, exiled to labor and timber camps in the north, massacred and destroyed. For anyone who knows the situation here, as well as the writer in question clearly does, this is the deliberate and ingenious perversion of fact." Not content to claim that there was no mass hunger, let alone millions more starved to death, Durante did what he could to dissuade others from trying to uncover the truth of the matter independently. Not only did the West know everything going on, why the Russians and Ukrainians themselves knew it too. "The Soviet press has made no secret of the food shortage and its effects," lied Durante. "There is no need of a foreign observer to tour the villages, where it commonly happens that the disgruntled or disaffected elements talk loudest while others are busy working. There is something uniquely craven about a journalist telling others explicitly that there was no need to investigate areas to which travel was forbidden for obvious reasons. Fortunately, there was one reporter who did not agree that there was no need of an independent observer to tour the villages, and he did exactly that. A young Brit named Gareth Jones had worked as a private secretary to Prime Minister Lloyd George before becoming a journalist. It was on the strength of his connection to the former prime minister that he was allowed access to the Soviet Union in hopes of strengthening ties between the USSR and the United Kingdom. On March 10, 1933, Jones took a train from Moscow toward the Ukrainian capital of Kharkiv. Though he was just 27 years old, Jones had been around the halls of power enough to know when something wasn't adding up. Rather than disembark the train at his destination, Jones got off 40 miles early and proceeded to walk through the Ukrainian countryside and see for himself just what was going on. Unlike all his other fellow journalists, Jones knew better than to accept the words of the Soviets and to be content that whatever was happening in these forbidden areas, it couldn't be all that bad. This was an era where cameras were nowhere near as ubiquitous as they would be several decades later. As such, there remains virtually no photographic evidence of what Jones saw with his own eyes, and of course, taking photographs of the mass starvation, which officially wasn't even happening, was completely illegal. We only have Jones' notes of what he saw and heard. As he walked through village after village, the peasants all told him the same thing. We haven't had bread for over 2 months. We're doomed. After he left the Soviet Union, Jones held a press conference announcing his findings, and his articles were syndicated in various publications. The pushback was enormous and immediate. The Soviet ambassador to London ripped into Lloyd George, and George disavowed any knowledge or connection to Jones' trip. The restrictions on reporters traveling outside Moscow were tightened. Jones had not been entirely alone. Malcolm Muggeridge had as strong of a leftist pedigree as anyone else in Great Britain. His father had been one of the founders of the Fabian Society, dedicated to gradually transforming the United Kingdom into a socialist nation via incrementalism. The Fabians were strongly interconnected with the London School of Economics, and they were instrumental in the creation of the British Labour Party. Yet he too had learned something of what was going on in the Ukraine. Cleverly, Muggeridge filed his three stories via diplomatic bag as a way to get them out of the USSR while bypassing the eyes of the censors. The worst reaction to Jones was perhaps that of the Moscow press corps, who colluded to announce to the rest of the world that Jones was a fabulist at best, if not simply a brazen liar. And taking the lead in this once again was, of course, Pulitzer Prize winner Walter Duranty. His 13-page New York Times article was titled, "Russians Hungry But Not Starving." There was no one to defend Jones, and that's where things stood. Even Muggeridge did not stick his neck out against all his colleagues on Jones's behalf. Hitler was rattling his sabers in Berlin, and one mustn't do too much to upset his archenemy, Joseph Stalin. It is difficult to calculate lives lost when the numbers are so high and when there is a concerted effort by the authorities to minimize or deny that atrocities had occurred. The current historical consensus of what has become known as the Holodomor is that almost 4 million people starved in Ukraine alone, with over 1 million others in the broader Soviet Union. The media in the USSR had been boasting for several years about the booming economy, naturally leading to increased population growth. Statistically, the predicted population was expected to be 170 million in 1937. Yet when the census came in, the number came in at a far lower 162 million. Those results were never published. Publicly, it was claimed that the census had been disrupted by contemptible enemies of the people. Then came the repercussions for gathering truthful information that reflected poorly on both Stalin and the Soviet Union. The head of the Census Bureau was executed along with his colleagues. In Ukraine itself, the Kyiv-based editor of Soviet statistics was killed, as was the head of the economics department at the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. The replacements to all these men understood what their job was, and when they redid the census, they dutifully reported a population of 170 million. Malcolm Muggeridge was asked decades later what the consequences were for him letting the world know that the famine was an organized one. "Me? What happened to me?" he mused. "Oh yes, I couldn't get work." Gareth Jones, on the other hand, was murdered while on location in northern China in 1935, with both his family and Prime Minister Lloyd George believing that he'd been personally targeted by his assailants for political reasons. His death came one day short of his 30th birthday. In September 1957, a destitute Walter Duranty wrote to New York Times publisher Arthur Hayes Sulzberger requesting a monthly pension for his past work. Though in the August 24, 1933 New York Times, Duranty had claimed that any report of a famine in Russia is today an exaggeration or malignant propaganda, by 1941, even Duranty had to admit that "I myself was lamentably wrong about the extent and gravity of the man-made famine in Russia during the fight to collectivize the farms in 1930-33, but every reporter who's worth his salt tries always to tell the truth." Whether this was a confession that Duranty was not worth his salt or another brazen lie in the service of denying the murder of millions of people is somewhat ambiguous. Sulzberger chose not to give Duranty a pension. But despite the fact that the journalist hadn't worked at the Times for 17 years, and despite the fact that Durante had repeatedly lied about mass starvation in the paper of record, Sulzberger nevertheless cut Durante a personal check for $2,500, exactly half the average annual salary at the time. Chapter 5. They Try to Live a Human Life. Despite Stalin's ability to keep the famine hidden from Western eyes, he was not able to persuade an increasingly hungry Russian citizenry that all was well. It's relatively easy to persuade a captive population that there were military